It's been estimated that out of over 16 million World War II veterans, only a little over 1 million are still around today. In this special Memorial Day edition of Homefront, I talk with my favorite World War II and Korean War veteran. We talk about some untold stories of what it was like back then. Welcome to Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host. As a writer, speaker, and former legislator, we discuss limiting government, fiscal responsibility, and fair taxation. I'm a mother of seven and a wife of one for over three decades, so I bring you my personal experience. And now it's time for Homefront with Cynthia Davis. Welcome to Homefront, and today we have a special guest, Gordon Gosch. He's a veteran of both World War II and the Korean War. Gordon shares some personal stories of what it was like to be in the Navy in the 1940s and 50s. He is also my dad, so welcome, Dad.
Well, thank you, Cynthia. It's great to be here with you.
So you joined the Navy when you were 17 while World War II was in progress. What year was that, and what was the world like back then? And what made you decide to sign up for the service while our country was at war?
Well, all those questions, see if I can answer them with one answer or an extended answer. I was 17. It was 1945. We were still at war with Germany and Japan. And the recruiters were still coming to our high school at that time. A lot of my friends had already preceded me into the services, and some of them had been injured and some fatally. But the Navy recruiters came to our high school, and they got an assembly hall, and we were allowed to take an examination to see where we might place in the Navy. The results of the test I took indicated that they were willing to put me in the what was then called the V-12 program for continuing education in university. And under those circumstances, I signed up and went into the Navy. Kind of interesting how it started. I was at a train station going to Great Lakes. The traveling companion with me was another man named Mel Gregory, who was from Flint. I was living in Pontiac, Michigan at that time. And we started talking about what was important to us and found that our relationship with the Lord was pretty significant. So we had a good visit on the way to Great Lakes. But a lot of things happened there. We started at boot camp in 1945, and from there they went on to several other schools.
So how did you find out that World War II had gotten over, and where were you when you heard the news?
I was on my way to Great Lakes when I heard the news that VE had been declared, victory in Europe had been declared while I was at Great Lakes, August 14th, that the Japanese surrendered, and I was at Great Lakes at that time.
What is Great Lakes?
Great Lakes was a naval station for training new people, and they also had several schools there, Navy schools, but it was located just north of Chicago on Lake Michigan. Kind of an interesting thing. I mentioned this fellow Mel that I'd met on the train. We got to the training station. We were assigned to barracks, and Mel and I agreed we would have prayer because we were really kind of frightened and unsure about what the future held, but we had started that by our bunks. Pretty soon other men in the service in our barracks, our company, wanted to pray with us. And we just, every night, that was the way our whole barracks ended up. Prayer was pretty important at that time. A lot of the men were dependent upon something like that to give them the assurance that they were in the right place and would be protected.
Was the country seeming to be more Christian during that time? Was it hard to find other Christians?
No, it wasn't hard to find other Christians, but the other thing that was important too was that at that time the entire country was cordial toward anybody in the military, and the military was close to each other, and when you're serving at a battle station or something right next to somebody else, there's a nearness. But the same thing applied when we went to different cities. Chicago is an example. If you were wearing a military uniform, people would offer to buy you a cup of coffee, or they would offer you to pay for your lunch, or they would the transportation, public transportation was complimentary. Ball games, I got to see the Cubs and the White Sox play complimentary, simply because I was in uniform. But it was a good sense of everyone pulling together at that time.
So where is Great Lakes located?
Just north of Chicago on Lake Michigan.
Okay, and then?
South of Milwaukee. While I was still at boot camp, the war was over now with Japan, and they no longer were offering the V-12 program. They did the next best thing. They gave me an increase in rate and sent me to medical corps school as a medic in the Navy. That took me to San Diego, where the school was at that time. I completed that training there. They sent me back to Great Lakes to the Naval Hospital, where I received further training in independent duty and giving anesthesia. Sometimes it was necessary for me to give spinals or general anesthesia, and I had to know how to do that, blocks. And I was trained as an operating room technician, working in the operating room, setting up the operating room for the surgeon and making sure everything was sterile, preparing the patient for surgery, and then following up afterwards with the patient to make sure he was doing all right. And it was an excellent training program. I was there for several months, then transferred to the U.S. Naval Hospital at Annapolis, Maryland, which is where the Naval Academy is, then transferred up to Alaska, to the Aleutian Islands, Kodiak, ADAC, and had some experiences there that were kind of unusual. You know, I'd hoped to be aboard a ship, but we were on an island that was buffeted by snow and heavy winds, and a lot of the men were pretty lonely. In fact, when we had a serious injury or a patient that needed extended rehabilitation, we never kept them on the island. We'd send them back to the States, and preferably to the Los Angeles area, where they could recover faster. Morale was important in healing too.
So how long were you in Alaska?
I was in Alaska for about 6 months, August to December, and that was interesting. I had received orders that on December 24th to go aboard the ship USS Helena, a heavy cruiser, which was the flagship of the 7th Fleet in the Pacific Ocean, and that made me feel very comfortable. I was in charge of the operating room on that ship, and any injuries, any surgery that was required in our 7th Fleet would come over to the Helena, to my operating room, where we would take care of the surgery. My faith was very important in helping me to get through, but also sharing it with others was a way of strengthening them and giving them some reason for knowing that there was a purpose in their being there aboard that ship.
So once you got aboard the Helena, did it take you somewhere outside of Alaska?
Oh, that was the nicest part. From a six-month period in Alaska where you rarely saw the sun or the moon because we were so far north, the Helena stopped in at Pearl Harbor. We were there for 10 days, and whenever we weren't having surgery, I could go ashore and spend the day, and whenever there was liberty, I kind of was one of the first people on deck to go ashore, and that was at Pearl Harbor in Waikiki, and it was a very pleasant contrast to what we had known previously.
Although Pearl Harbor was shortly after it had been bombed, did you see remnants, or were there still boats?
There were still some ships that were had not yet been recovered or removed. But it was a very nice place to visit. The climate was beautiful. The interesting thing about I have not been to Pearl Harbor since that time in 1946, but at that time there was very little refrigeration. It was a lot more primitive than it has become. It's still a beautiful place, but then the ship went on to China, and we spent 3 months in the China waters, Shanghai, Qingdao. I spent time up in, at that time it was called Peking, which is the capital of China. It's now called Beijing. And we were with two other doctors, and we were doing kind of a study of what the Nationalist Army needed in the way of medical treatment supplies.
When did you get your accordion?
I acquired my accordion from a friend of mine who was also in the Navy, and he was in Italy. I sent him the funds, and he purchased it and brought it back to Annapolis, and I carried that with me to Alaska. I carried it with me aboard the ship, aboard the Helena, through the 47-48, playing the accordion on the ship as a source of relaxation. Made many friends in China and Japan, and we had assignment off the coast of Korea to make sure that things were going well there. Being the flagship of the 7th Fleet made a pretty interesting cruise. We enjoyed that. Brought me back to Long Beach, where I was discharged in 1949. I went to University of Toledo.
Okay.
And while I was there, one of the men who was in the Naval Reserve said that they needed someone to teach the recruits that were the new trainees first aid. And so every Thursday night I would go to the naval station and train in first aid, some of the basics, controlling bleeding and showing the signs of a stroke or heart attack, how to use a tourniquet, simple things like that. One night while I was there, a higher officer came to the training station, wanted to know why I was there in civilian clothes, the only one that didn't have a uniform, and they told him that he was a volunteer from the university that was training first aid. He said, well, he's got to be in uniform. So they said, well, would you sign this little paper saying that you would be in the inactive Naval Reserve, you'll never be called up, you will have a uniform and will comply with the naval regulations. I did that. I should have gotten counsel, but because within a month of my signing that, I got a request to report for duty.
So were you already discharged from the Navy?
Oh, I had been discharged from the Navy, complete discharge. And then I signed to be in the inactive Naval Reserve so that I would comply with the legal requirements of the services in having a uniformed instructor.
You were in college. You were at the University of Toledo studying.
I was studying pre-medicine.
Pre-med, and then?
And then they took this to the dean of students and showed him the letter that I had to report. I had 10 days to report to back to duty, and he said, oh, I'll take care of this. And he wrote a letter to Washington saying that this is an important student. He's doing very well. It would be best for the country for him to continue in his education. And sat back and thought, well, that took care of that. A day or so later, we got a response saying that we will give you 1 week extension only. So he wrote another letter, and the letter came back saying, we cannot give him any further extensions. We need the skills he has acquired of in operating technique and setting up operating rooms and giving anesthesia and such. And they insisted that I had no further extensions possible.
So they took you out in the middle of a semester?
Well, they allowed me to take my final exams. The day that I took my last final exam, I had to report to Great Lakes.
Because you were now in the reserve?
Yeah, now I'm in the reserve. My inactive reserve status has been made active. But I got aboard the train. I headed right for my last exam to the train station. Took the train to Great Lakes. Got there about 10 o'clock at night. Very cold. And that started my second tour of duty in the Navy.
Had you met my mother yet?
Yes. We had met. That was an interesting thing. There was a campus activity, intervarsity fellowship, is an intervarsity Christian fellowship that was forming, and another a friend of mine, student, a friend that I'd made, that and I were primarily the ones that were initiating this on the campus, and we needed to get some recruits, and so he brought in a girl that he was interested in, and I had met your mother, and we had lunch together two or three times, and we found that we could get along well. We formed that club on campus, and that's how we got to know each other. I had to go back to Great Lakes, where I was reassigned.
How did you tell her that you're leaving?
Well, I just told her that I had orders to report back into the Navy.
Were you engaged yet?
No. Huh? No, we hadn't gotten that far.
Just a nice girl.
But they said that they really needed me, and they transferred me to Norfolk, Virginia, and I was assigned to the USS Midway, an aircraft carrier. We equipped it. I was responsible for getting all the medical supplies that I thought we might be needing for combat or for any casualties. I used to drive, though. A friend of mine from Toledo, Ohio, had an old Plymouth, and the two of us would drive from Norfolk to Toledo and then back to Norfolk on a weekend. That's probably about 1,000 miles round trip, and we did that and left Friday night and got back to the ship, or Sunday evening. It was a favorable time. I met some good friends, and while we were waiting to get our ship fully equipped for being battle ready, we made some other trips to Haiti, where we brought some supplies to some of the impoverished people there. We also went to Cuba, and we were there for a time as well, with bringing supplies to not only to the naval station there at Guantanamo Bay, but providing some help to some of the civilians that would come to the naval station for aid.
Castro hadn't taken over yet.
No. It was still under Baptista. And Baptista was the head of the country, and everything seemed to be going all right. While we were there, there was the very cordial relationships between the civilians and the Navy personnel.
Did a lot of the sailors buy cigars while they were there?
Yes, I think they did. I had one vendor come up to me and say he had a whole stalk of bananas on his shoulder. And he asked me if I would like to buy some bananas. And I said, how much? And he told me, I think it was something like a quarter. A couple of bananas, that's good. So I said, yeah, and I gave him the quarter, and he took this whole stalk of it, not a bunch of bananas, but a whole stalk of bananas, and threw it on my shoulder. And we ate it all the way back. I gave bananas to everybody I met along the way.
Hi, friends. Do you like what you're hearing? Then go to my website. It's CynthiaDavis.net, and sign up for my newsletter. You'll get all this information and more when you sign up for my email reminding you of when you'll hear another podcast and letting you know what's coming up next. Besides, we always have a little bit of humor at the end, so go to CynthiaDavis.net and stay in the loop. For those of you who don't like email, go to my Facebook page. It's called Homefront with Cynthia Davis. And make sure you click the like button. That way, you'll have a convenient way to see what we're doing and to get the word when another podcast is released. That's Homefront with Cynthia Davis on Facebook. My website is CynthiaDavis.net. That's where we keep all our good stuff. So if you want to get our newsletter and find more podcasts, go to CynthiaDavis.net. Hey, let's stay in touch.
Then the ship went from the Caribbean to the North Atlantic and did some exercises there. We were going to go into Istanbul and Turkey, but because there were some difficult situations with the Russian government, we couldn't pull our fleet into those straits.
Now, this was while the Korean War was going on?
Yes, yes.
So do you know any sailors who died during the Korean War during that time?
Well, when we were off the Korean coast. We did take some Marines and soldiers aboard the ship. There was a hospital ship there, but we were well equipped to handle all sorts of casualties, and we took care of bullet wounds and shrapnel and frostbite. It was really hard to see these 18-year-old kids with their feet frozen, and having to correct that condition for them so that they wouldn't get gangrene. But those are some of the things that we don't usually deal or think about, as they not just the combat wounds, but the wounds and the infections and the diseases that you acquire in a foreign country that has different sanitary conditions than what we have in our country.
Most people in America only know what they have seen on MASH about the Korean War. It was before many of us were even born. It was obscured by the Vietnam War. We've had some difficult times in this country, but I'd like to hear about what the religious climate was like. We obviously didn't have as many influences from the media back then as we do today. Today we find ourselves in a place where the military went from giving homosexuals a dishonorable discharge to now where they can be openly homosexuals. They can even get benefits for their friends. And we now are reading about the atheist chaplains they're trying to install in the military. So how has the tone and climate of the country changed since when you were first enlisted and where we are today?
When I was at Great Lakes, they invited me to be a part of the Great Lakes choir. It was well-trained. It was well-respected. We were received in many prestigious places, and, of course, the songs that we sang were hymns, generally. When we were there, the chaplains were always very cordial. Some of my best friends were chaplains at every station I was at. They cared about the military. They counseled them, made sure that in my contact I was encouraged to start a Bible study aboard ship, and a Bible study while I was stationed at Adak Island, supplied with all the materials that I might need. Everywhere we went, it seemed like there was encouragement to pray often. When you went to the battle station, you were told, it's all right if you want to pray, but stay alert, be ready for following any instructions that might change what you were doing. I just think that the chaplains were a tremendous source of inspiration and encouragement to us. Sometimes there were patients or military people that became patients because they could not stand the stress or the strain of the circumstances we were under. And the chaplains would counsel them and then pick someone like myself to be an encourager to that individual to make sure that they could stay on their duty responsibilities and have someone they could talk to that cared and would help them get through their difficult times. Sometimes it was just being a friend. Sometimes it was reading the word, a comforting word. Sometimes it was asking about their family and reminding them that they had a family that loved them and cared for them and was eager for them to get back home safely. But when our ship was in the Mediterranean, it was a chaplain that said, would you be our military shore patrol and a medical shore patrol? And would you be in charge of the tour groups that we might want to set up, which provided an opportunity for us to, when the ship was in port long enough, we could take a few days to go into Greece and Switzerland and France and Spain, North Africa, and Gibraltar, these ports along the Mediterranean that were memorable, and the attitude of the guys was pretty good. In fact, on one trip, I took 15 of our personnel up to Paris, and you know, that could be, you might say, wow, that would be pretty wild, but the 15 of them knew that before we had breakfast every morning, we were going to have prayer, that we would have safety and no problems during the day. On one day we were there, we went to the American Church in Paris. There were 15 of us. We all sat together. They said, "Welcome to the U.S. Navy. We're glad you are here to worship with us." And today our speaker is going to be the Dr. William Graham. And it was, of course, Billy Graham. I still remember the message that he gave about some churches are like the time a doctor gave you a prescription and you took it and you got well. And you said, "Boy, that's a nice bottle. I'm going to save it." And then you got sick again later and you put some other medication in it that was not good for you and you wondered why it didn't work. He said, some churches are like that. They are changing also. They are not caring for the individual as much as they did at first. Maybe that's not taking place now, but at the time it was a concern that we needed to keep our faith and we had to, that our faith would keep us strong and faith comes along with hope, and that's what all of us in the service needed. We needed our hope and our faith, and they kind of go together.
Where were you when you got shot at?
Well, that was in China. At the time, that was in 1948 when the communist people were taking over nationalist China. And I was in Shanghai at that time, and streets were narrow, and I knew somebody was coming up around the corner of the street. As he raised his gun, I stepped into a gate opening, one shot, that was all he fired, and I waited, and nothing else happened. I came out, and that was clear. But there were others that had other weapons that they would use. We were at the Great Wall. You could see the communist armies to the north of the Great Wall. A lot of the nationalist soldiers, especially the young ones, nationalist army was recruiting, and both the communists also were recruiting teenagers to fight. And some of these Chinese teenagers didn't want to fight. They wanted to go home, and if they went home, they would be captured and taken back up to the lines up there. And where I was at the Great Wall was where they were, the Nationalist Army was just north of it, trying to hold back the Communist Army. And they would take these teenagers and hand them a gun and put them right up in the front lines. And it was almost suicidal. I guess that was their way of disciplining and controlling people so that they wouldn't go AWOL. I saw more harm done to other people than to ours, although we did have some losses from our ship. I went ashore with the Marine Landing Party from Qingdao. We went to assist some civilians that were being moved from Tientsin to American civilians to Qingdao. And we were there to make sure they got back safely. Encountered communists along the way that tried to stop us. But
did you know anybody who was tortured by the enemy?
Well, we had one man on our ship when we were in Shanghai that went ashore alone, got drunk, didn't come back, and I was sent along with the military police to see if we could find him the next day. Found him in an alley. They put they cut out both his eyes and left him. He was still in shock or drunk, lying in the alley, but both his eyes have been taken out. That's a torture that no one should do. But sometimes when people are not caring, they will do terrible things like that.
What advice would you give to our listeners today if you were running the military for how we could restore honor and make it what it used to be?
In boot camp, everyone went to church service. We were expected to do that. The chaplain was highly respected, and we were all encouraged to, anytime we had any questions, don't hesitate. Get to your chaplain and tell him what your problem is. And that's why I mentioned that there are times when, if it were a medical, mental problem, the chaplain would bring me in sometimes to help to make sure that individual was healthy again. The chaplains were really far more respected. They were considered a friend. Anybody that went to them was, we don't have that. I think that's one thing that is lacking. We need to encourage our men to have faith, trust, and hope, which are virtuous. That will serve them no matter how old they are or wherever they are. They need to have that strengthened in them. Our culture seems to have changed, not only the military, But in civilian life, our culture seems to be swinging away from a faith, something that sustains us through difficult times.
I appreciate having your perspective, and this has been very helpful. Is there one last parting thought you want to give to the listeners across America?
Perhaps the most important thing is to keep in mind that anyone that serves in the military is under a great deal of stress. In combat, it's a terrible thing to have to harm somebody and be told that that's necessary for your own survival. That's always been there in war. But I think that if we can somehow respect our military, no matter who they are, which branch of the service, and encourage them and greet them and thank them for their service, it will make a big difference in their morale. And I think it would give them an encouragement in this concept of faith and hope that they need as much or more than any of us do.
Well, thank you for being on our show today. This has been a pleasure and a delight.
Hey, it was nice of you to ask me to be here. Thank you.
This has been another edition of Homefront on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Cynthia Davis and hope you enjoyed our program. Please join us next week when we offer another infusion of truth, honesty, and solutions that will grow people bigger and shrink government smaller. Thank you for joining us. See you next week.
That kid.